It's the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith. This show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Katha Pollitt is best known for her column in The Nation, where her work has appeared since 1980. She's a feminist, a keen observer of American culture, and the author of 2 books of poetry and 4 essay collections. One of those essays, Learning to Drive, appeared in The New Yorker 13 years ago and has recently been adapted into a film starring Patricia Clarkson and Sir Ben Kingsley. It's about Pollitt, a New York native, learning to drive at age 52, a sturdy framework for a story to begin with, but it's interwoven with moments of her life that are revealing, poignant, and at times hilarious. I spoke with Pollitt about the film, but before we hear that conversation, let's listen to a clip from the movie. This is a conversation between Patricia Clarkson, whose character's name is Wendy, and Ben Kingsley, playing the part of Darwan, a Sikh Indian driving instructor. They've just finished a driving lesson, and we begin to learn more about Darwan.
You have a master's?
I was a university professor, like my father.
Why do you teach driving?
For a better job, I would have to take off my turban, shave off my beard. People think I look dangerous. But this is how I know who I am, and here it is too easy to forget.
Do you ever get back for visits?
I can never go home to India. It's part of political asylum. I couldn't get to see my dad before he passed away last year. I missed my mom's funeral too, but then I was in prison there.
Why?
There was no justice for Sikhs.
How long were you in prison?
Long time.
That's Patricia Clarkson and Ben Kingsley from the film Learning to Drive. I recently spoke with Pollitt after a screening of the film at Madison Art Cinemas in Connecticut, where she took questions from the audience afterward. We sat in the back of the emptied theater and talked about writing the film and what it's like to see a movie based on your work.
I go back and forth. Sometimes I think, oh my God, Patricia Clarkson is playing a character loosely based on me. That's amazing. I mean, she's just so fantastic. Why can't I wake up and look like her? Why can't I just be her? But then other times it feels quite different. I feel distant from it in that I feel, well, it's very loosely based on what I wrote and on me, and I can watch it in a kind of dispassionate way. The first time I saw the movie at the Toronto Film Festival, I saw it completely through the screen of what I had written, and I was a little freaked out. The second time I saw it at the New York premiere, I thought, my God, they must have recut the movie. It's so different.
Why were you freaked out the first time?
Well, because you expect everything that you wrote to be there. Like, there weren't any Sikhs and Ben Kingsley-type people in my story. In my story, it's a boyfriend, not a husband. My husband is very carefully portrayed as a really wonderful person, which he is. And my daughter was 9 years old at the time. She wasn't at all like the daughter here. I have to say that my real-life daughter, Sophie, is the last person you'd ever find on an organic farm. And so, you know, there are all the ways it's different are very striking because you're comparing them with your own life and with what you wrote. But then after you see it another time, you're just taking it as a movie and enjoying it for that.
But you can't forget that it's based on you.
Well, you almost can. It's a funny thing, you know. I mean, they're very different kinds of art. And one thing that seeing it made me realize is how specific cinema is. It has its own language. It has its own. For example, it has a lot fewer words. You know? So, like, sometimes when you read a screenplay, it will seem thin because people aren't talking all that much. But then when you see it on the screen, well, of course, because there's all the visuals and there's the action and there's shots of things that, you know, scenery and all like that. And it's very, very dense, actually, although on the page it doesn't seem like it will be that way. I love movies.
And you love this one.
I do. I do. I think it's really good. I think the performances are unbelievable. I think, Patricia Clarkson, of course, and Sir Ben. But also, you know, let's not forget Sarita Chowdhury playing the arranged wife of the Ben Kingsley character. You know, she was wonderful in Homeland, where she plays Mandy Patinkin's wife. But here, she plays a character who is almost illiterate, a village woman who's married to this highly educated and very, I wouldn't say domineering, but very self-assured man. And she's completely at sea in America, and she's very lonely. And I think there are a lot of immigrant women like this. It takes them a while to learn to negotiate America and to find a community. And I thought that her performance was so poignant and so sensitive. And at the end, when she finally gives this big smile, you know, that is the sign that there's hope for their marriage and hope for her in America.
So Patricia Clarkson plays Wendy, who's modeled after you. Wendy and Sarita Chowdhury's character, while they have a lot of differences, they also seem to have a lot of similarities. They are both trying to figure out their new roles in life.
Yeah, that's a good point. And also I thought that the... I think Wendy, in the course of the movie, becomes a less fraught and fragile character. That she does kind of calm down. you do feel a new chapter is opening up for her, and it'll be good.
Are there any moments in that film that made you wince?
Well, there are moments where I felt, well, I would never do that. One of them is after Wendy has been dumped by her husband in a very sort of public and sudden way, and she goes home and she throws up. I would never do that. And the other is when she tries to seduce him when he comes to pack up his things, and in a way that is not very seductive. I have to say, because she's just, it's an idea she has, you know, she still hasn't really absorbed that their marriage is dead. And that is also something I would not do. But Wendy is not me. Wendy is different. She is, I would say we both live in our head a lot, but I feel that the moments when she comes out of living in her head are a little more shocking to her, even. You know, she's so surprised that her husband is leaving. She's just completely shocked. And yet, you know, then when she says, well, he's done this before, you know.
Yeah, how did that make you feel as the feminist?
Well, I thought, you know, wake up. And what about those other two times? Maybe, you know, that she's so quick to sort of brush them aside. But even as I'm saying all these things, various embarrassing scenes of my own life are coming back to me. So let's move on.
The book is now out in paperback.
It is.
And you are going to be touring?
I'm mostly touring for my other book, Pro Reclaiming Abortion Rights, which has also just come out in paperback. So I've got these two hats that I'm
Is it interesting
now.
To have this particular work that you wrote just about a dozen or so years ago to be coming back to life again?
Oh, it's great. It's really wonderful. I feel it has a whole new chance to be at, you know, ranking 500,000 on Amazon. No, it's really great to have the book have another life.
I remember an interview that you did several years ago where you talked about maybe being a little hesitant about putting this particular work out in the world because it was so personal. Can you talk a little more about that?
My best friend said to me, I told you not to publish that story, and I was wrong. She said, after she saw the movie. And I thought, oh, you did? You told me not to publish? He says, yes, yes. I thought it was a really wonderful story, but you shouldn't publish it. It would, you know, it would come back to haunt you in bad ways. I had no memory of that. But there were people who thought I shouldn't publish it. And I am glad that I didn't listen to them. And all you writers out there, when your friends tell you not to publish something because it's too personal, don't listen to them. Just publish it.
And that was the piece that you said came so easily to you.
Yeah, it did. I had a lot of fun writing that piece.
What are you working on now?
Well, that's a good question. I'm mostly just writing my column and some other journalism.
In The Nation.
And I hope to write more personal essays. I just feel like I'm coming back to that way of writing. After I finished that book, I thought, well, that's that. I've now put every memory I have into a book. I have no more memory left. But recently I thought, well, wait a minute. You know, what about that? What about this?
Did you have conversations with your daughter? It is so personal, and you reveal so much about you and your persona. Did you have conversations with her?
Well, she was I can't remember if she was still in middle school or first year in high school. I gave her the story to read, but you know, kids are not interested in their parents' writing, and I don't think she read it. And then when it came out, some of her classmates did tease her because of some of the sexy bits. And I felt bad about that. But, you know, you can't live your life because of what some evil 13-year-old is going to say to your child. And I think now she's very proud of it. She loved the movie. So, yeah, she did. You know, here's another funny thing. I did not see that piece as being very self-revelatory, because I thought it was sort of carefully constructed to seem as if it was written as if I'm telling everything, but actually I didn't tell everything. So to me, knowing everything that really happened, I'm thinking, oh, you're Kathy, you're so restrained. But some other people didn't see it that way. Yeah. So, you know, there are just layers and layers of one's own writing. And the relation of writing to real life, quote unquote, is never one-to-one. It just isn't, because you're inventing yourself on the page as a character that you were writing. It's as if it's fiction. I had to invent Katha, and that Katha in that story is not exactly like me in her affect, in her personality. I'm a much, I don't know, sort of sharper person than the Katha in that story, who's sort of sweet. Who's sort of sweet and romantic and idealistic and doesn't really understand at all what's happened to her or why, although she comes to more understanding and as the story goes on. She's naive, and I guess that's a part of my character, but it's not the whole. I couldn't have written that story if I really was that person. You have to have another layer, the layer that is controlling the material. I mean, all writing is like that, I think. There's a part of your mind that is constructing the reality in which another part of your mind is acting in. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm. How is your writing different now than it was when you first wrote that piece?
Well, I don't know how to answer that question, because I don't think I read my writing like a reader. I read it like a writer. And here I'm just speaking for myself, but I read it sometimes through the lens of what I meant to say that somehow didn't get on the page, you know, or the, like, I find this especially with the poem. You read it and you think, oh, I never did think of the right word there. You know, that poem still is, it's in a book, but it still feels, there's still that word, you know, that, why did you end the line there, you know, stuff like that.
That's Katha Pollitt talking about the movie Learning to Drive, which is loosely based on Pollitt's essay by the same name. The film is written, directed, and edited by women. It stars Patricia Clarkson and Ben Kingsley. It's out now in select theaters. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith. Next, a look at the mysterious ingredients found in popular foods and products we use every day. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in today for Faith. Ever hear of ingredients like sodium monostearate, castoreum, taurine? They sound like they could be household cleaners. But let's take castoreum, for example. This actually comes from the castor gland of a beaver. Okay, so that's interesting. But that same substance that comes from the beaver gland ends up in things like cigarettes, some ice creams, candy, even baked goods. These are actually all ingredients found in some popular food products. If you've ever wondered what polysorbate 60 is, and even if you haven't, you won't want to miss this conversation with Patrick DeGiusto. He wrote the Wired magazine column, What's Inside? He's an editor at Make magazine, a contributor to the New Yorker's science blog, Elements, and Popular Science, as well as other publications. He's done a number of interesting things, including stand-up comedy. DeGiusto's taken his wit and wry sense of humor and sprinkled it throughout this entire paperback titled, This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth? From eggnog to beef jerky, the surprising secrets of what's inside everyday products. It's part education and part pure fun. He joins us by phone today from his home in New York. Patrick DeGiusto, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So let's go back to castoreum. Would you like to say a little more about it?
Well, I think you've really covered it. It's a secretion from a beaver's gland located, well, it depends on how you want to define it, but let's just say between the back legs. It's sort of similar related to musk, which is, you know, another secretion from deer. It has a very heady type of smell and apparently a very nice flavor if you use it in small enough amounts, because the entire cigarette industry used only about 8 pounds of this stuff to create a year's worth of cigarettes. That's about 400 billion cigarettes. So a little castoreum does go a very long way.
So let's jump right into the book and talk about one of your favorite products. What would you say that is?
I think it might be Cool Whip, just for the sheer artificialness of the entire thing. It's basically fake whipped cream, which, if you think about it, we do not have a whipped cream shortage in America. We never have. But apparently the folks at Kraft really did think that this was a necessary product back in the early 1960s, and they actually managed it.
I wonder why they thought we needed that.
I have no idea. Remember, this is back in the age when the Jetsons were on TV, when people thought that we would be eating food in, you know, like pill forms, you know, one pill a day. So maybe just the very idea of artificial food was a thing back then. I mean, you had a lot of them going on. Cool Whip is the one that has really lasted the longest.
There's a lot of really interesting scientific information that's presented, like I said, in a lighthearted way, which makes it very entertaining. And I don't mean to downplay the science, because there's some real science in here. The book is laid out in two parts. Part one deals with popular products we eat, and part two looks at products we use. And I should say, you're not trying to take down, you know, any American food corporations or scare people. Why did you write the book?
Absolutely not. The idea, we've had a couple of people recently, a couple of authors put out these books that really do seem, you know, destined to scare people about what they eat. That was never my intention. This was more just geeky fun about, you know, wow, what is inside all these things that we're eating? How does this ingredient combine with that ingredient to make an entirely new product? Some of the things that we've done are completely natural. We take a look at the chemicals inside red wine. I mean, if it's done right, red wine can be, you know, the most organic, natural thing that you have in the course of a day. Mm-hmm. And yet, if you take it into a laboratory and take an analysis of it, you know, it's loaded with natural chemicals. And what are they? And, you know, how do they all work together? I've always found that fascinating. And fortunately, the readers have also found this fascinating. For the longest time, What's Inside, which is the column that this book is based on, was the most popular feature in Wired magazine.
And was your idea, I should add. And you did that column for a number of years.
Yes, from 2006 to 2013, just about a good solid 7 years.
There's a product that you talk about, Doritos Late Night All-Nighter Cheeseburger Chips. I love this. You said you discovered that in your local Target. When you came across it, you asked yourself, how did they manage to do that?
Why did they manage to do that?
Exactly. That's the first question. Why? Who sits around saying, you know, it would be great if we made Doritos that taste like cheeseburgers? You can spin out fantasies. You know, did they get a bunch of college stoners together?
Right.
And say, what would you like? And they'd be like, you know, dude, we want cheeseburgers, but we don't want to go out and get them. So let's put them in Doritos. You know, maybe that works. We have no idea why they did this, but it really was an actual Doritos flavor. It's harder to find now. I think it still exists. And the amazing thing, it really did taste like cheeseburgers. One of the things that I always made sure to do is that for nearly all of these products, you know, there were a few that I didn't. For nearly all of these products, I actually went to the store, bought it with my own money, and actually used these products, you know, to taste what it tastes like, mouthfeel, do you get sick afterwards, things like that. So, yeah, we wound up with a big, giant bag of cheeseburger Doritos chips.
This is Patrick DeGiusto. He's written this book, This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. It's about the mysterious ingredients found in many popular food items and products we use. And so here's how it works. You take a product, list the ingredients, and explain what they are, how they're used in the product, and list some of its other uses. And you also give a backstory with each product, which talks about the research process, where you got the information, and sometimes what I call your journalistic adventures, where you describe some of the craziness you've encountered in your story quests. Do you have a favorite?
Yes. There are so many that are favorites. The simple rule is that if a company is small or family-owned, they tend to be much more forthcoming. If a company is incredibly large, a big multi-conglomerate, let's go back to Doritos, which is owned by PepsiCo, they tend to be the most recalcitrant. They tend to hide their stuff most completely, not necessarily because they're afraid of their own ingredients. They're more afraid of how this itinerant writer is going to come along and spin their own ingredients. I used to tell them that I was not out to play gotcha. I was just out to, you know, enjoy the geekiness of understanding what these things were. And that didn't seem to mollify them. They weren't too happy about that. To answer your question most directly, I would say my personal favorite would have been eggnog. Now, you look at eggnog on a store shelf, it seems like, you know, one of the more innocuous things, maybe a little heavy in cholesterol, but still, you know, it's a fun product. It turns out that for the past 30 years, eggnog, nearly every commercial eggnog you've bought, has been violating federal law.
Which you have a really good time with in here, too. And they deserve it.
Yes, exactly. What it basically boils down to is back in the 1980s, the FDA said that you shall not put yellow food coloring into your eggnog because that would make it look like there were more eggs in the product than there really are. And that would be fraud. And that would be wrong. And yeah, you can understand that. That makes sense.
Sure.
If you go to the store shelves right now and look at the eggnog that's there, nearly all of it contains yellow food coloring. So you have to ask yourself, okay, there's a law that says no yellow food coloring. They all contain yellow food coloring. What's the loophole?
Right.
And we researched and researched. And this took a solid month. We called food chemists. We called law professors. We called lawyers. We called lawyers who actually work for food companies against the FDA. And we laid the whole thing out for them, and they said the companies are wrong. We would advise companies to stop doing this. And we couldn't find the loophole. Finally, we actually contacted the National Archives down in Washington, and we found a single piece of paper dating from 1982, which said that the law barring yellow food coloring from eggnog will still remain on the books, but it will not be enforced until a hearing can be held in which both sides can get their say. Now, that was 1982, and there is absolutely no record that this hearing was ever held. So that's like 30 years now. No one has held this hearing. Everyone who used to work at the FDA who are expecting this hearing, they're all retired or even dead by now. This hearing is never going to happen. And it sounds like a lot of fun, you know, eggnog, it's a trivial substance, but it does make you wonder how many other foods and how many other regulations are on the books but will never be enforced.
For sure.
It really does make you think.
It definitely does. And that yellow food coloring hasn't been linked to any problems per se. It's just an appearance issue.
Exactly. They almost all use a totally natural yellow food coloring. It's a plant extract, which just happens to look a nice warm orangey yellow. And you find it in loads of foods. It's in cheese. It's farmers actually feed it to their chickens to make the egg yolks yellower. So it's totally natural. It's not harmful. It's called annatto, which you might even find on your spice rack because it's a spice. So technically, even organic farmers can feed this totally natural plant substance to their chickens to make brighter, yellower egg yolks.
So you just mentioned organic. You've also found some interesting things where government agencies are concerned when it comes down to the words natural and organic.
Oh, yes. Technically, there really isn't a working definition of natural. The definition of natural is really interesting because it's almost like freshman-level philosophy. Technically, here it is. Once a food product has been harvested, it is no longer fully natural because it has been processed. Just by, you know, having a human pull it off the tree, it's now not natural. So the FDA basically says, who can say what is natural and what is not? Technically, this is how it ends. The agency does not object to the use of the term natural if the food does not contain added color, artificial flavor, or synthetic substances. Now, remember that, because what they said was contain added color. They are defining added color as added after the fact. So remember how we talked about you could feed yellow food coloring to chickens,
right,
and it would come out in the egg yolks? That's fine, because the chicken produced that. If you were to take the eggs and somehow inject them yellow afterwards, that would be wrong.
Funny how that works. We're going to take a quick break and then continue our conversation with Patrick DeGesto, author of This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith Middleton. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in today for Faith Middleton. We're talking with Patrick DeGesto about his book, This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. It's a humorous and scientific look at some of the interesting ingredients found in food and popular products we use. The book is based on DeGesto's Wired magazine column, What's Inside? So, as an example of your sarcasm throughout the book, I wanted to read about the product Beano. You describe an ingredient in Beano, which is potato starch, and you write, like the Kardashians, industrial quality potato starch is a flavorless, odorless, colorless substance that exists mainly to take up space, which I thought was just so clever.
Yes, potato starch does have that quality. It's pretty much just there. You don't know why it's there. It really doesn't do all that much that's worthwhile. But it does exist to take up space. And if you're making a pill, let's say, such as Beano or some other pharmaceuticals, the actual drug portion of the pill is usually very, very tiny. But you need something to swallow. So most of the rest of the pill will be a collection of cellulose or potato starch.
I alluded to the fact that you've had some pretty interesting careers. Can you say more about some of the jobs that you've had in the past?
Well, as you mentioned, I was a, you didn't say this, but I was a fairly unsuccessful stand-up comedian. I tried that in college, and that went sort of well, but I didn't continue that. I've been a computer programmer, a robot programmer for the Federal Reserve Bank. Most people are not aware that most of their money is shuttled back and forth in the vault by robots, simply because they're much more efficient. And I also, I designed experiments that rode on the space shuttle, mission STS-107, the final mission of Space Shuttle Columbia. Some of my experiments were on board.
Wow. Patrick, what is your background?
Really, just a very good journalism degree from Manhattan College, with a minor in computer science, and you just combine the two and, you know, take it where it leads you.
I don't know that it would lead everybody to where it's led you, that's for sure. You also give some bonus trivia, like what that little black button is for on the bottom of the Easy Cheese aerosol spread.
Yes, yes. That was absolutely loads of fun for us. That was the first thing we did. The very first column was Easy Cheese aerosol spray cheese. Because once again, this is what we were talking about earlier, the prevalence of like really totally artificial food in the early 1960s. You had Cool Whip and you had this aerosol spray on cheese. What exactly is it? Well, it turns out it is real cheese, or as close as Kraft gets to real cheese. It contains an extra amount of vegetable oil because you want it to be sort of wet and flowy as it comes through the nozzle. And the rest of the can is filled with nitrogen gas. And the nitrogen gas, the cheese is sort of kept in a little baggie attached to the nozzle. And the nitrogen gas actually squeezes the cheese out when you press the nozzle. Now, that little black button at the bottom is very important because, first off, that's how they fill the can with nitrogen from the bottom. Secondly, it turns out that these cans are a serious explosion risk if they ever catch fire. Because one of the bad things about it is that, you know, the cans can explode from the heat, and what you've got is incredibly hot melted cheese flying all over the place, which is only like one step up from napalm. And so you have to be very careful with that. So that little button at the bottom of the can is also a relief valve. If, you know, a pallet of the cans catch fire, the relief valve is supposed to pop out before the cans explode so that the cans won't explode.
Sounds like a brilliant invention.
This requires some real, real forethought, and they did it very well.
You had mentioned how in the research of these products, you would go to the grocery store yourself and buy them with your own money and try them out. I wanted to get you to talk about your Listerine story, because this is the kind of example of what you'll do for a story.
Yes. Well, if you think about it, Listerine and many, many other mouthwashes, if you read the label, it says quite clearly they are something like 35% alcohol. And that's, you know, almost 70 proof alcohol, which is, you know, a good sized drink.
For sure.
So why don't people drink Listerine and Scope and all the other mouthwashes to get drunk? Well, the simple fact is that there are a great many people who actually do that. The writer Stephen King, in his autobiography, he's confessed that during his really heavy drinking days, his wife accused him of drinking the Listerine, and he swore up and down that he never drank the Listerine. Secretly, he drank the Scope because it tasted better. But yeah, there are some people who will go to any lengths, including drinking mouthwash, to get drunk. The government knows this, and they've done a little tweaking to mouthwashes. In order to sell alcohol for consumption, you need a tax stamp, and you need to make sure that it's not sold to people under 18, and it can only be sold at certain times of the day or the week. So rather than go through all those limitations for mouthwash, the mouthwash companies instead poison the mouthwash. They will add all sorts of stomach-churning chemicals that are not really supposed to kill you, but they are supposed to make you so completely sick to your stomach that chances are you will throw up before you've drunk enough to actually get smashed.
And you just had to try this.
Yes. I took basically a shot glass of Listerine, and it was one of those things where I felt so bad that you actually hope that you're going to die.
Jeez.
But you don't actually die from it. It just they've designed this so well that a person who takes a shot glass of Listerine will never take a shot glass of Listerine ever again.
You also looked into heroin, which was kind of interesting to me. But you comment in the backstory that everybody, including your girlfriend, warned you not to try that one.
It is sort of nice to have this real gonzo journalist reputation among your colleagues. And I absolutely drew the line with that.
Glad to hear that.
Yeah, I didn't at the time, I didn't even know where to go to get heroin, although I did make sure to go and visit the place in New York City where heroin was first sold legally. Because not many people realize this, that heroin was an actual product made in the laboratories of Bayer aspirin.
Interesting.
The Bayer aspirin people were looking for a better painkiller, and they came up with heroin. This was back before the days when companies had to do serious testing of their products, so they didn't. And eventually they wound up finding out that this stuff was heavily addictive. Addictive, not in a way that it would just like sell more product, but like seriously badly addictive. And so they stopped making it. So yeah, for quite a while, heroin was sold over the counter right here in New York City.
We're talking with Patrick DeJusto. He's written this book, This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. Let's go to one of my favorites, chocolate cherry cordials.
Yes, aren't they wonderful? Chocolate cherry cordials. Now, this is a chocolate candy that has a liquid center with a cherry, an actual maraschino cherry in the middle of it. And, you know, the fun thing is, how exactly are they made?
Right.
Some of them take the easy way out, in which you make just like a little cup of chocolate, and you put the cherry into it, and you fill it with, you know, sugary liquid syrup, and then you put a cap on it. And, that, you know, that's simple enough. That's the easy way to make it. But that always leaves a seam around the bottom, and you could tell that it was made from two pieces. The really, really good chocolate cherry cordials are absolutely seamless.
Right.
You know, that leads to the question, how is it done? It turns out you take a cherry, you put it through all sorts of chemical baths to turn it into a maraschino cherry. Maraschino cherries are not like from the country of maraschino. They're usually from Michigan, actually, but they're steeped in marasca liquor. They are then placed in a sugar-coated, it looks almost like a bullet of sugar. They are completely covered with sugar, and then they are sprayed with invertase, which is an enzyme that is found in saliva, and that saliva enzyme starts to break down the sugar. Now, while it's still all solid, the sugar-coated cherry then passes through this Willy Wonka type of chocolate waterfall that completely coats it without making a seam.
Ta-da.
So you've got this perfect seamless coating that surrounds this sugary bullet with the cherry inside. It's then packaged, and while all this is happening, the saliva enzyme is very slowly starting to convert the hard crystal sugar into sugar syrup.
Isn't that something?
The whole process of conversion takes about 2 or 3 days. So by the time it goes from the factory, you know, onto a truck, onto the store shelves, by the time you buy it, the chemical conversion has already taken place, and you bite into a liquid center with a maraschino cherry in the middle of it. And it's all due to the saliva enzyme. Now, to be totally fair, before anyone gets grossed out, if they're not already, this enzyme is taken from yeast.
Not your mouth.
I want to make absolutely clear, no one came by and actually spit on your cherry. It is an actual yeast extract, totally natural, and it does the same job.
So glad you clarified that. This is Patrick DeGesto. He's written this book, This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. It's about the mysterious ingredients found in many popular food items and products that we use. So you've done some pretty interesting research, and some of it, I would say, is kind of disgusting.
Yes, yes. Probably the most disgusting thing that I ever researched was Head and Shoulders. Not the actual product itself. That's not so bad. But do you know exactly what dandruff is?
I do not.
Dandruff is a yeast infection on the scalp. It gets even more disgusting from there. Basically, the little yeasts are on your scalp, and they live off of the natural oils in your hair, and they chew on your skin. So that's what little white dandruff flakes are. They are dead skin that has been eaten by yeast so they can get to the oil in your skin. And the question is, how do you create a shampoo that is strong enough to kill these yeasts without seriously damaging your scalp, without seriously damaging your hair, and without seriously damaging the person underneath all of them? Yeast are very hardy creatures. They don't die pretty easily. So shampoo manufacturers have had to do quite a bit of research to find various chemicals. Most dandruff shampoos are based around the chemicals methylchloroisothiazolinone and just plain old methylisothiazolinone. These keep not only the yeast in check, but any bacteria that live off of the yeast and might live in the shampoo bottle. All of these come together to kill these creatures on your scalp.
CoverGirl Lash Blast Luxe Mascara. You describe this as the iron oxide to give you those magnetic eyes.
Yes. What exactly is in the stuff that you paint on your eyelashes? For the most part, it's a various collection of iron and other metallic oxides, which just, you know, they are specifically designed to look incredibly black and incredibly lustrous. So you get that sort of pearlescent sparkle in your eyelashes. Most people don't even realize that it's there, but it really does exist, and it really does make the eyelashes look very, very interesting to look at.
True.
So the people who put this together really know what they're doing, but it does make you think all these iron and metallic oxides on your eyelashes, are there any side effects to this? And there are two. The most impressive one is that most people don't realize this, but just about any bottle of mascara that you deal with is magnetic.
No kidding.
We were absolutely astounded when we actually tried this. I went to my girlfriend. I said, do you have any mascara? We dug in a drawer and pulled out mascara. And we held a magnet up to the bottle of mascara, and the magnet stuck to the bottle of mascara because there are so many iron and metallic oxides in it. But the other side effect you have to watch out for, because if you go in for a cranial MRI while wearing mascara, the metal in the mascara will actually distort the MRI.
Really?
And you will not get a valid reading. It winds up, and this was actually a problem in the early days of MRIs, it winds up looking like a melanoma on your eye because it's just this bizarre mass of stuff.
You'd think you'd need a lot for that to happen, but I guess not.
Not very much, no.
This is Patrick DeGesto. He's written this book, This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. Now, I want to talk about diamond matches for a second. If I were a business owner, I wish it were this company. Nothing really to keep up on, no technological advances, no improvements to be made.
Matches pretty much stopped evolving in the 1800s, yes.
And because why?
Because really, they pretty much had reached the apotheosis of matches. It's like you really can't get them any better than they are right now. They are a mixture of many different chemicals that when mixed together, and heat is applied, and heat is applied through friction, they will just spontaneously burst into flame. They will burn for a set amount of time. And then I found this absolutely fascinating. Why do most matches go out? You would think that a match, you know, it's on a wooden stick. It's just going to burn all the way through.
Right.
The wooden stick is made of aspen wood. And the fascinating thing about aspen is that it is highly flame resistant. The Forest Service actually encourages people to plant aspen brakes in their woodlands to help stop fires from spreading. So the wood itself is naturally fire resistant. It is then coated with a mixture of molten glass and other chemicals that smother the fire once it gets to the wood. The fire actually melts the glass, which then seals the flame and stops any oxygen from getting to it.
That one was more complicated than I even imagined. You look at the matchstick and you think, yeah, that looks pretty simple, but much more went into that.
Exactly. And, you know, there's so much science and so much chemistry going on in a simple match, which really hasn't changed since the 1800s. So it's hard to think of a way to make a match any better.
Hmm. Is there any sort of conclusion you've come to after all the research you've done? You know, something like everything in moderation, because there are various times in the book that you point out that certain chemicals used in large quantities could really be harmful, but you'd need some huge amount of that chemical to cause any real harm.
Exactly. I think I know what you're talking about. Let's say Slim Jim.
Right.
Slim Jims are these meat sticks. To help keep them fresh on store shelves, they're loaded with sodium nitrates and nitrites. Yes, those can be very bad for you if they are eaten in serious quantities. I think we calculated that it takes something like 1,400 Slim Jims in order to poison yourself with sodium nitrate.
That's a lot of Slim Jims.
Really, no one's going to eat that much in one setting.
Or a lifetime, maybe.
Maybe. And, you know, it does, the chemical does wash out of your body over the course of a couple of hours. So unless you eat 1,400 of them in like 1 hour, it's not going to make you sick. And this is what I think is a little more important. It is so effective at killing bacteria that will grow in, you know, sausages and meat sticks that the benefits of this chemical, you know, from keeping you from getting, you know, botulism poisoning, the benefits are so much larger than the downsides, which you'd only get if you ate, you know, a ton of these things.
And that might be said about some of the other products as well.
Just about everything, yes. You see, the thing is, again, you have all these people who have, as I said, written books recently saying that all chemicals are bad for you. Don't eat anything with a chemical in it. Well, you know, the most organic apple taken off of the tree and brought to a laboratory is loaded with chemicals. It's made of chemicals. We, all of us, we're all made of chemicals. The point is to use these chemicals the right way without, you know, eating 1,400 Slim Jims, you're going to be just fine. You're actually going to be helped by these chemicals because they'll save you from botulism. Mm. If you think about it, there's no CEO who actually sits there and says, let's poison the American public. They don't want you to die. Believe it or not, they don't want you to die because they don't want the bad publicity. If you want to eat, you know, nothing but junk food, well, you have to make that decision that too much of this stuff is going to make you sick. Just about everything in moderation seems to me to be a fine way to go.
It's a fun book. Thank you for coming on the show.
And thank you for having me.
Patrick DiGiusto is the author of This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth, From Eggnog to Beef Jerky, The Surprising Secrets of What's Inside Everyday Products. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening.